products like bracken, balloon flower roots, and pine mushrooms. The mood music between the two countries improved a little in June 2000 when Kim Jong-il hosted a visit to Pyongyang by the South Korean president Kim Dae-jung. To the South Korean media, starved of news of the North and bored with the horror stories from defectors, Kim Jong-il came across as witty, clever, and willing to poke a little fun at himself. As it turned out, a massive misreading of a cunning psychopath. Still, the business climate improved, and Lee put in serious money to build the mineral water plant. He would provide the capital, the machinery, bottles, caps, and labels, and the North Korean side would provide the water from the ground and the labor. Kim told the paper that sales increased to 400,000 bottles a month. But the political weather began to turn when President Lee Myung-bak, a big skeptic on the sunshine policy, won the election in the South and took power in 2008. That July, a South Korean woman tourist enjoying a walk on the beach in the Mount Kumgang tourist resort was shot dead by a trigger-happy North Korean soldier, terrified of allowing her into a restricted area. Relations froze overnight, as the North stuck absurdly to the line that the killing was the fault of the tourist. In April 2009, the North launched a missile. In May that year, a nuclear test took place, nailing the coffin lid firmly down on the sunshine policy. And that meant that Mr. Lee, South-North entrepreneur, was screwed. When you apply for contact with North Korea, the Southern Korean government tells you to please refrain from doing so. They say, please refrain, but who is going to refuse a request from the government? They are basically telling you, don't do it. One day, a fax came from North Korea telling Lee that his contract was null and void. 3 years on, when we visited the place, the most up-to-date labels we found on bottles in the plant were for 2010. Our guides neglected to tell us it had been a ghost factory for some time. Then again, how could they? We moved on from the bottling plant to the water source itself, housed in a large shed. A local guide explained the various systems they used by means of a large coloured diagram on the wall. It might have looked technically very impressive had the power not been off. As it was, the entire technical briefing took place in the gloom, but no one said anything. It was like being there when the emperor walked past in his new clothes, naked to all and sundry. You had to pinch yourself and remember, no, this isn't a story, this is real. Not far away was the Chungsun Ri farm, which boasted an anti-aircraft battery on a hill, but no animals and no crops. It was weird. In farms around the world, chickens cluck and ducks quack, pigs snort, dogs give you a roomy eye, cows munch grass and sheep bleat. There were no animals of any kind. From a nearby apartment block, propaganda loudspeakers spouted out their boring, pedantic cry, but this being North Korea, the tape was fucked, and what you heard was a weird, inhuman screeching, like pterodactyls in Scooby-Doo. I asked Mr. Hyun, was the announcement telling us that thermonuclear war had started? He said no. The cold was bitter. No one stirred, no one cheered. It was hard to imagine anything more hateful than having no choice but to listen to the squawking that never stops at No Animal Farm. Outside the farm was a large concrete slab. On it, a giant statue shrine in bronze to Kim Il-sung, giving on-the-spot guidance, OTSG, to grateful square-jawed heroic farm workers and their Soviet-bosomed womenfolk. At every meeting between ordinary folk and Kim Il-sung, OTSG is handed out. As Myers writes, stories of Kim's on-the-spot guidance are alike not only in their depiction of the hero, but in their storylines and secondary characters as well. Both problem and solution are thus described in terms a child can grasp. Indeed, the leader's published remarks are always trite. Rainbow trout is a good fish, tasty and nutritious. We were asked to line up and bow in front of the Kim statue. Miss Jun stood at the edge of the front row to lead that row's bow. Mr. Hyun stood at the side of the second row to ensure the same-same. It was a Stalinist stage show circa 1953, frozen in time, more than half a century out of date. I bowed, crossing my fingers behind my back, but that subtle gesture was not captured by the North Korean cameraman. He just filmed the moment of obeisance. Perhaps it was just an accident of timing, or perhaps our guides had been sly in making us all bow 7 times to the Kim dynasty, 6 times in the mausoleum, and once again on our first proper day in North Korea. After that first day, the more we saw, the less likely any of us would be to bow to the regime's gods in bronze or stone. But at the beginning of the trip, we were still anxious to please, and unaware that the strange, hierarchical nature of the country meant that we, as Westerners, were treated effectively as members of the elite core group, and that meant, as well as being served as luxuriously as possible, we were also given some allowance for, if not dissent, then at least mock compliance. Our tour of the farm continued. We were taken to a typical farm worker's house, where we posed for photographs with 2 tiny, sweet little North Korean toddlers and their grandma. This may have been a natural event, but it felt like something that was prearranged and well choreographed, the lisping tots on cue for smiles at our cameras. 2 pictures of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il had pride of place in the house. In North Korea, I can't remember seeing pictures of anyone else. A North Korean defector, Mary Lou, later told me about the care that people have to take with the portraits. She said that the wall they are hung on must be bare and clear of any other objects. Only the portraits are allowed on that wall. They have to be cleaned every morning, wiping away any dust because you never know when the inspectors might come. And you can never put them on the floor. The inspectors test how clean the portraits are by wiping the top of the frame with a piece of white paper, looking for any dust or dirt. If they are deemed not clean enough, people are fined or punished in some way. But even here, in this propaganda showpiece, the truth had a way of seeping out from behind the film set. Through the window you could clearly see someone's washing hanging higgledy-piggledy on the naked branches of a tree in the freezing sun. Our last stop was the Ryanggang Hotspur Hotel, an old party hotel set in spacious grounds dotted with pine trees, with a Kalashnikov-toting guard at the gate. It turned out to be an architectural tribute to 1970s Bond villain kitsch, complete with hot tubs spouting pongy water from an off-bronze tap into an immense, badly tiled jacuzzi thing, as inviting as the low-tide Thames at Wapping. He Yong played table tennis for a bit until the power died and his ball vanished in the gloom. Dinner kicked off in an unusual way. Our hosts spread clams on a slab of cement, soused them with petrol, and then set them alight. Feeling a bit queasy, I pulled a face. Mr. Hyun, attentive as ever to the need to demonstrate the very best of North Korea, picked up a clam and opened it up 1 inch from my mouth. I lunged forward and ate the flesh. As petrol flambéed mollusks go, it went down my throat. Others were less enthusiastic, to the point of profound nausea, so Mr. Hyun carried on hand-feeding me the clams like an infant. After 3 clams, I felt I was placing diplomacy against the well-being of my stomach. Mr. Hyun offered me a hefty glass of soju, the local hooch. I proposed, here's not to thermonuclear war any time soon, and not wanting to seem a milquetoast, downed it in 1. The soju knocked out the taste of a carbonized clam a la Esso like a punch from Muhammad Ali. Mr. Hyun downed his glass, giggled infectiously, and then proclaimed that I was professor of drinking. These North Koreans, they know everything. Chapter 3. God, the Waxwork Father. Alex and I got up before dawn and walked through the softening light up a steep slope at the back of the hotel, led by one of the students, Erica. She had become fascinated by North Korea after watching an undercover National Geographic documentary on the country. She had gone for a walk the night before and found something she wanted us to see. From the top of a bluff on the very edge of the hotel grounds, you could peer through a bedraggled barbed wire fence and spy a sleeping town. In the grey luminescence, just before sunrise, the town looked unutterably miserable. It wasn't just dirt poor. Poverty stinks wherever you find it, but even in the polluted towns in the Katanga copper belt of the Congo, or in the gunfire-ridden barrios of Caracas, there's some sense of energy and hope that a few people, if they graft or use their cunning, can get out and end up someplace better. The crowded grey apartment blocks, like so many human hen coops, just on the other side of the fence from the core class's privilege and ease, spoke of hopelessness and helplessness, of a poverty of the human soul so deep no one in this town could possibly escape from it. The electricity was off, so the propaganda hadn't started up yet, but soon it would. Gripping the barbed fence, I wound up my reporter's voice, nodded at the misery in concrete ahead of me, and said, "Welcome to the real North Korea." Alex and Erica took some more footage and photographs of the town, and then we were off, hurrying back to the hotel before anyone noticed we had gone missing. History, the study of how the past moulds the future, is too important to be left to history professors, even fake ones like me. The unholy trinity of the Kim dynasty has ruled North Korea since 1945, and the man who most stamped his bloodline on the country was Kim Il-sung. But who was the real man inside the wax? The best book I've ever read that peers into the mind and soul of a dictator is a novel, The Porcupine, by Julian Barnes. It's set in a post-revolutionary country, clearly Bulgaria, where the old communist tyrant is facing trial. The old brute in the novel, Stoyo Petkonov, is based on the ex-dictator Todor Zhivkov. The trick that Barnes cleverly pulls off is to make the dictator act like a real flesh-and-blood human being, not just a creature from darkness. The dictator, with his back against the wall, comes out fighting, a bruiser, contemptuous of the lickspittles, funny, amusing, hard as concrete. Barnes, who conjures with the English language like a magician plucking out a rabbit from his hat, makes you sympathize with the devil. Zhivkov's Bulgaria in 1989 was a much less dark place than Ceausescu's Romania. Back in December 1989 and January 1990, Romania was frozen, half-starved and frothing with fear. Bulgaria was so much better, it had power and light and food and calm, we called it Hollywood. But the heft of The Porcupine makes a simple point. You don't get to be a dictator of a country unless you've got serious qualities of conviction, self-belief, a hardness of the soul. That goes for Kim Il-sung, too. Kim Il-sung left Korea when he was 7 years old. Apart from a brief spell back in Pyongyang when he was 11, he spent the next 23 years of his life outside his own country. The simplest explanation for the taunt by his enemies that when he spoke Korean, he quacked like a duck. A dysfunctional childhood and broken education, he never completed high school, gave way to the great formative influence on his life, being in a guerrilla band in Manchuria, surviving by kidnapping, robbery, and extortion. In 1940, on the run from the Japanese, he fled into the care of the only regime he ever admired, Stalin's Soviet Union, where he spent the next 5 years sitting out the war. Adrian Buzo, one of the harshest critics of all Kim Il-sung's historians, writes that his broken education, guerrilla brutalism, and Stalinist tutelage framed the man and his regime, anti-intellectual, deeply mistrustful of the outside world, contemptuous of morality. He lived in a predatory political subculture of force which encouraged in him an outlook that accepted callousness and criminality as a daily reality. In other words, Kim Il-sung was a Korean version of Al Capone. Kim Il-sung's official biography is a fiction. It exaggerates and airbrushes and tells lies about history. More sympathetic Western historians than Buzo paint a softer picture, pointing out that young Kim's achievements were real enough. They say he survived an extraordinarily difficult youth, his nation under the thumb of hated occupiers, exile, loss of his father at an early age, and then effective loss of the rest of his family, to become a hardened warrior in a cruel guerrilla war where the odds were almost impossibly stacked against him and his men. From 1935 to 1940, the Japanese army hunted Korean communist fighters like Kim and their Chinese communist masters in Manchuria with a ferocity that is hard to imagine. Captured fighters were guillotined. The guerrillas repaid that ferocity in spades. Kim and his men survived by kidnapping rich Chinese farmers, extorting guns, money and food, or else ears or heads would be cut off. The Japanese police used bribery, torture and threats to play the Koreans against one another so cleverly that the Chinese communists, sick of a string of betrayals, turned on the Koreans, torturing, imprisoning and executing innocent men. At one point, Kim Il-sung was locked up by the Chinese communists, suspected of being a spy, a necessary introduction to how their system worked, perhaps. Hunted, paranoid, criminal, murderous, frozen, starved, Kim Il-sung was the only Korean officer of his rank in Manchuria who survived to escape to the safety of Vladivostok in the Soviet Far East in 1940, after the Japanese rolled up the resistance. Much of the detail of Kim's war is opaque or lost in the gush of the subsequent personality cult, but it is fair to say that as a communist resistance fighter, Kim survived, and to that extent, he was successful. Buzo notes the scar tissue. His experience in the Manchurian guerrilla campaign seems to have rendered him extraordinarily callous and indifferent to suffering. It is also fair to say that every single terrifying feature of North Korea's gangster dynasty he created was forged in the guerrilla war in Manchuria. The paranoia, the criminality, the murder, the inurement to starvation and the cold, even the kidnapping. This is a man whose moral compass was smashed to pieces in one of the darkest and least known wars in history. North Korea is the result. Once Kim was gifted the pretense of power in October 1945 by a Soviet Union looking around for a Korean they could play with, he seized his opportunity with both hands. He died in July 1994, an absolute monarch, outliving the Soviet state by 3 years. Kim Il-sung started a civil war he almost lost, survived, prospered, killing his enemies, real and imaginary, in a series of purges, and was able to hand power on to his son. So the very first thing to say about Kim I is that he was a tough and shrewd tyrant who outfoxed his enemies throughout his long life. "Let them hate, so long as they fear," was the bespoke aphorism for tyrants adopted by Caligula. Kim Il-sung's philosophy of power perhaps can be summed up in an even crueler phrase: "They must fear me, but they must love me too." No other dictator in modern history, neither Hitler, nor Stalin, nor Mao, nor Pol Pot, has demanded such slave-like devotion from his people. and got it unto the third generation. Kim Il-sung was born Kim Sung-ju on the 15th of April 1912 in Pyongyang. His country had been annexed by the Japanese only 2 years before, a gross insult to Korea's national pride. Koreans had traditionally looked down on the Japanese as rustic country bumpkins, but in 1905 the Japanese had flattened the Russians in a short war, knocking the prestige of the Tsar and marking the first victory of an Asian military might against a Western power in the modern age. The rise of Japan and Kim's part in his country's struggle against it scarred his life. Kim's father and mother were both Christians. His maternal grandfather had been a Presbyterian missionary, a fact readily admitted by the official biographers. That would seem to be an odd admission for a communist ruler, but an understanding of Christianity's role in the making of Korean independence makes it less so. Around the turn of the 20th century, Confucianism was the official religion of Korea, but its grip on people's faith was weak, especially in the north. One layer beneath the surface was an ancient shamanism, or paganism, which still has its sway amongst the poor today, away from the Kim dynasty's propaganda. Christian missionaries, especially Protestants, arriving from the 1880s onwards, when the Korean government signed a treaty with the Americans, were extremely successful in Pyongyang, which became known as Korea's Jerusalem. There was a political, patriotic component to Christianity's popularity. Confucianism was, in essence, Chinese, Buddhism, Japanese, Christianity, a third force which somehow chimed with Koreanness. Come the Japanese takeover of the whole of the Korean peninsula in 1910, the men from the land of the rising sun turned out to be an effective recruiting sergeant for Jesus. Christianity was somehow considered to be un-Japanese. Today, South Korea is one of the most Christian nations in the whole of Asia, with around 1 in 4 of the population holding to the faith. In the north, despite decades of repression, Christians continue to oppose the regime with a heroism that is breathtaking. Kim Il-sung was to adopt another faith from the West, Marxism-Leninism, and his belief in that soon blotted out the old religion. His autobiography states, "I too was interested in church, but after a while I became tired of the tedious religious ceremony and the monotonous preaching of the minister, so I seldom went." Other accounts suggest that he deliberately downplayed his old devotion. For example, they say that both Kim Il-sung's father and he himself played the church organ. Mischief makers might add that the Presbyterians' stress on the elect of God does not sound so very different from the core class of the Korean Workers' Party. Kim's father had been a peasant farmer who became a backstreet doctor, treating people with traditional herbal medicines. When Kim was 7, the family upped sticks and shifted across the border into northeastern China. Kim described his family's move into exile as being like fallen leaves to the desolate wilderness of Manchuria. The relocation had a lasting legacy for the young Kim. He started school and became fluent in Mandarin, which stood him in good stead when keeping the trust of the Chinese communists was a matter of life and death. The downside was his Korean started to suffer. To make up for weakness in his mother tongue, shortly before his 11th birthday, his father packed him off to Pyongyang, a journey of 250 miles, so that he could brush up on his Korean while staying with his maternal grandparents. 2 years later, he was back in Manchuria. Shortly afterwards, his father, never a well man, died at the age of 32. Kim continued his education in Chinese and learnt his Marxism from a teacher, Shong Yue, at the age of 15. Shong became a famous historian who later recalled his star pupil being diligent and asking the right sort of questions. One young Korean friend, who later became a pathologist in Nebraska, admired the young Kim greatly. He was not interested in trivia, but very enthusiastic on political and social problems, imposing, a charmingly handsome man, a future leader. He had able leadership already in those days. He stood out like a crane in a flock of pheasants. The rest of his youth is a murky story. Kim's activity as a young communist was discovered by the Chinese police, and he was jailed in the autumn of 1929, aged 17, in the city of Jilin. Kim was banged up in a cell in the cold, sunless side of the jail, which in winter was wallpapered with frost. The police tortured him, breaking fingers, says the official version. Breen writes cynically that this allegation of torture is unconvincingly written up. I agree. There is no detail. After some friends bought him out, he left his family and joined the guerrillas. First, you had to adopt a nom de guerre. To begin with, they called him Star of Korea, but dropped that in favour of Be the Sun or Il Sung. So in English, his name would be Kim Be the Sun. The narrative now gets clogged with propaganda. Su, who is always fair to young Kim, points out the Japanese military issued several reports on Kim and produced maps detailing the whereabouts of Kim's troops. Korean newspapers, then of course under Japanese censorship, regularly reported on Kim's banditry. Guerrilla wars are never fought according to Queensbury rules. The crueler the government forces, the crueler the guerrillas become, in part to survive. If the Japanese tortured and killed captured guerrillas, so did Kim Il-sung and his men against people they suspected of being in league with the Japanese. Some South Korean anti-communists have asserted that Kim stole the real Kim Il-sung's name, leaving the poor guerrilla leader a kind of man in the iron mask. Su states bluntly, Kim is not a fake. The start of 1935 saw a breakdown in relations between the Chinese communists and their Korean brothers. Koreans were tortured into confessing they were secretly working for the Japanese. They weren't, of course, but hundreds were executed. Kim survived this baptism of paranoia well, perhaps because his Chinese was so fluent and his manner so steely self-confident. In 1937, Kim led a brief raid across the border into Japanese-occupied Korea at Pochonbo. Not a great battle, but enough to make a name for himself with the Japanese enemy, his Chinese communist allies, and, observing development from not so far away, officers of the Red Army. Kim dynasty propaganda later airbrushes out the involvement of the Chinese and providing a rear base and supplies the Soviets, and asserts that he was the effective leader of a standalone Korean communist military operation in Manchuria. Lankoff notes grimly, this version has nothing to do with reality. No Korean People's Revolutionary Army ever existed. Officially, Kim Il-sung and his merry men fought like tigers against the Japanese from within Korea. In February 1942, the guerrilla band was holed up on the slopes of the sacred Mount Bakdu on the Chinese-Korean border when Kim's heavily pregnant wife, Kim Jong-suk, gave birth to a son, Kim Jong-il. The magical birth was heralded by signs in the heavens, a swallow, a double rainbow across the sky over the mountain, and a new star in the firmament. The official story is rubbish. By 1940, the Korean resistance in Manchuria was pretty much broken. In December 1940, Kim and his gang fled across the Amur River to the safety of the Soviet Union. There they camped out the rest of the war in the garrison town of Khabaretsk. Buzo writes that Kim Il-sung's exposure to Stalinism happened at a pivotal time in his life, that it was his only positive experience of the outside world. Stalin's portrait hung in every railway station, for example. Kim Il-sung liked what he saw, and he wanted it for himself. Buzo makes a subtle point about Stalinism, that as well as being about a command economy, the drive for heavy industry and the personality cult, it embodied the traditionalism of old Russia, borrowing enlightenment, if that is the right word, from the likes of Ivan the Terrible. Kim's version was never just Stalinism, pure and simple, but a blend of that and ultra-traditionalism. The Israeli sociologist Shmuel Eisenstadt defined key elements of that as legitimation of the ruler in religious terms, the political role of the population embedded in their societal roles, limitation on the access of members of peripheral groups to the political center, and limitation of innovation. Buzo, who sticks the boot into Kim Il-sung the hardest, defines the regime's ideology as Kimism, a blend of Korean ultra-traditionalism, Stalinism, and the criminality learned when he was a guerrilla. That seems to be a fair assessment, and not so far from Myers's sense of the regime's ideology in the 21st century as being a xenophobic racism. It was in Khabarovsk in 1941, according to reliable Soviet and Korean sources, that Kim Il-sung and his wife, Kim Jong-suk, had a baby boy known in Russian as Yura and in Korean as Jong-il. Kim Jong-suk, known in Russian as Vera, was described as being an attractive and smart peasant woman with noticeably darker skin than other Koreans, a feature she passed on to her son, Kim Jong-il. The power that eventually broke Japanese imperialism was neither Korean, Chinese, nor Soviet. The American dropping of atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima ended the Second World War, but came so fast that it caught the great powers unawares. Military facts on the ground and negotiations between Stalin, Truman, and Churchill at Potsdam had divided up Europe into Western and Eastern-controlled halves, but the division of Korea happened on the hoof. Two American colonels in the War Department, one of them Dean Rusk, subsequently a Secretary of State under JFK and LBJ, studied a map, drew a line along the 38th parallel, and took over the South. They appointed an aged nationalist, Syngman Rhee, to run things south of the border. The Republic of Korea, ROK, the state Syngman Rhee created, was, to begin with, not much different from Franco's Spain, neo-fascist and profoundly undemocratic, where enemies got tortured or murdered. But in 1987, civilian rule replaced the military there, and from then on, it has gone from strength to strength. For Koreans, the division was brutal, uncalled for, and undeserved. The schizophrenia between the South and the North had no Korean origin, but was a consequence of the new Cold War game. In time in Korea, the war would blow hot. What many Koreans feel is so unfair about their divided country is that Nazi Germany was broken into two because of Hitler's folly. The Koreans had been the victims of fascist aggression by Japan, but they too suffered division, which is continuing into the 21st century, 2 decades after the fall of the Berlin Wall. But who was to be the face of the North? In 1945, Mao and the People's Revolutionary Army were still fighting the Kuomintang, the inept, corrupt Chinese conservatives. The communists who were calling all the shots were based in Moscow, not Beijing. To begin with, the Soviets ran North Korea pretty much as the Japanese had, as a colony, to be looted, the women raped, ordinary civilians walking along the road bumped out of the way by drivers in their jeeps. For the first 3 years, the supreme ruler of North Korea, according to Lankov, was General Terenty Fomich Shtikov, a political commissar who in 1938 had presided over a committee investigating counter-revolutionary crimes. plain English, he was one of Stalin's most trusted mass murderers. But Stalin's men knew that naked Soviet power could not last for long. They needed a front man, someone they could use, but not so strong that they could not control him. To be the leader of the other Northern Korea, the Soviets looked around and could find no one who was perfect. The Korean communists, who had survived the Japanese occupation in Seoul and Pyongyang, were discounted as being unreliable. The obvious candidate was Choe Man-shik, Korea's version of Mahatma Gandhi, who had preached non-violent resistance against the Japanese, but now that they were gone, wanted independence immediately. The more the Soviets studied Joe, the less suitable he became. And then they remembered Kim Il-sung, tucked away in their back pocket. Kim surrounded himself with his old comrades, 200 former guerrillas who had been with him in Manchuria. But of course, they had never been the only Koreans to fight the Japanese. Brave communists had faced torture and death inside Korea. Others had fought the Japanese in Manchuria, alongside the Chinese or the Soviets. All of these factions had their leaders who waited for Kim to make a mistake. Kim Il-sung did not win power by popular assent, far from it. He was not well known inside Korea and overtook other communists' claimants to the throne. But Kim's Soviet backers already had plenty of experience at suppressing dissent. In North Korea, they rolled up opponents, gagged free speech, strangled free political parties at birth, rigged elections, and anyone who disagreed was entertained by the secret police. The job of suppression was markedly easier than in Eastern Europe because there had been no tradition whatsoever of free speech, parliamentary democracy, or free newspapers. North Korea slipped from colonial occupation to authoritarian dictatorship relatively smoothly. Despotism was some way off yet. The Soviets presented their new man to the people of Pyongyang at a mass rally in October 1945. Photographs in which Kim was seen to be sporting a Soviet sash were later airbrushed by North Korean propaganda so as to remove the taint of him being a Soviet puppet. But that's exactly what he was. Kim read out his prepared speech in his halting, thick-tongued Korean. Some thought that this young man could not possibly be the famous guerrilla leader Kim Il-sung, and the myth of the man in the iron mask had begun. Kim was a young-looking 33-year-old in a blue suit that was too tight for him. Joe's personal secretary, clearly a hostile witness, said he sported a haircut like a Chinese waiter and made little impact on the crowd, speaking in a monotonous, plain and duck-like voice. Another witness to the events in that year said that Kim reminded him of a fat delivery boy. Some people in the 300,000 crowd started to whistle and yell abuse. It wasn't a perfect reception, but if you've got the secret police on your side, that doesn't matter. Joe, Korea's Mahatma Gandhi, was leaned on to support the Soviet fiction of trusteeship, a shadow policy he recognized and rejected as effective colonization. Elbowed out of power, Joe was humiliated, then arrested by Soviet police and held in the Korea Hotel for a time while they hoped he would become more accommodating to Soviet policy. He was accused of secret cooperation with the Japanese police, but no evidence was put forward. This seems like a black lie. He did not bend, so his hotel room was downgraded to a prison cell, and then he vanished. It's most likely that in October 1950, when the Civil War was going badly, with the United Nations troops pushing north, and Pyongyang was evacuated, Joe was shot in the traditional Stalinist fashion with 9 grams of lead to the back of the head. Chapter 4. No photos, no photos. After breakfast, we left the Hot Spa Hotel and headed to the West Sea Barrage, celebrated in the following poem. O shine for all centuries to come, great monument of the 80s built by our design, our technique, our strength. The great creation made in our own way. Only a great leader, a great party can conceive the idea. Only a great people can build you, West Sea Barrage, the world's greatest. Rise high to symbolize the power of self-reliant Korea and tell and retell the everlasting achievement of our great leader forever and ever and ever. Shoot the poet. The West Sea Barrage is an aquatic Stalinist folly. It cost $4 billion, larger in scale but no different in kind than my hotel door not fitting its frame. The dream was that by building a barrage 5 miles across the Tadong estuary, where it flowed into the West or Yellow Sea, they would make more arable land, conserve more fresh water for irrigation, and have a road and rail bridge to boot. On the day we visited, halfway across the thin thread of concrete rippling across the surface of the sea, our coach came to a stop. An ancient lorry slowly reversed, then tipped its cargo of enormous rocks into the waters. Mother Nature is gobbling up the barrage, and the dream is in danger of falling back into the sea. Behold, Kim Il-sung was no less silly than King Canute when he commanded the sea to obey him. At a morose visitor centre, adorned with the usual whatnotery of photographs and tributes to Kim's 1 and 2, we were invited to sit down and watch a movie. It turned out to be a comic masterpiece. The film opens with footage in black and white, the picture's juddery, of a long shot from a crane, of worker ants beavering away on the causeway, flags rippling in the breeze, 2 big lorries dumping rocks into the sea. A commander with a chunky walkie-talkie gives orders to 2 flunkies who shiver in the cold. Rocks slide into the sea with an almighty splash. The film switches to colour, and 3 red bulldozers, moving like synchronized swimmers in 2 perfect unison, shove soil into the great splashes, all to a rousing-ish soundtrack of plinkety-plonk music. The finale is a cheesy colour snap of Bad Elvis grinning at the camera, in the foreground, cherry blossom, in the background, the estuary, sliced in 2 by the ribbon of concrete. The film, especially the early sequences, looked so ancient I assumed the dam had been built in the 1950s, and only when writing this book did I realise that it was started in 1981 and completed 5 years later. I tried to ask some boring questions about the barrage, but got nowhere and gave up. As ever in North Korea, it's virtually impossible to get at the facts, but there are concerns that, far from adding to arable land, the dammed river has backed up upstream, losing land. As at the 3 prongs, the mausoleum, and No Animal Farm, by osmosis, one sensed our hosts would have appreciated a more positive response from us. I felt like a truculent, spotty Herbert teenager in a sulk. Yet the dam was falling apart, and it was hard to see any real benefit it had made for ordinary people. The force of the regime's propaganda was beginning to have entirely the opposite effect on us. The louder the taped soundtrack of praise for the regime, the more hollow the reality. Along the road out of the barrage, we saw our very first disabled North Korean. He was a young man on crutches who looked as though he might have fallen off a motorbike. The lack of disabled people in a poor nation is one of those peculiar absences that make one feel uneasy about North Korea. All societies have disabled people, poor ones especially so. If they have vanished off the face of the earth, somebody powerful has made that happen. Our next destination was the Da'an Heavy Machine Complex, a vast industrial eyesore with an enormous smokestack dominating the surrounding area. Roadworks meant we could not take the direct route to the plant, so our coach was forced to make a long detour into the local town, cross a river, and then go back to the complex. This turned out to be bad news for our minders, because on the long way round we ended up seeing all sorts of things they did not want us to see. No smoke emerged from the chimney of the complex. It was hard to be definitive from the moving coach, but it looked as though the main building was a ruin, empty sockets where there should have been windows and walls. Although out of the capital, we were in the Pyongyang corridor, very much the richest area of the country. Some analysts say that North Korean heavy industry is now working at only one-fifth of its previous capacity in the 1980s. From what we saw with our own eyes in this complex, it was five-fifths dead. Up in the northeastern city of Chungjin, previously known as the City of Iron, one reporter described the industrial zone as a forest of scrap metal. Our coach slowed to a crawl, picking its way along a heavily rutted road, running parallel with a river. The more we saw, the worse it got. Out in the sticks, away from the capital and the tourist-friendly roads, there was real poverty on view, raw and mean and not to be photographed. Underneath a lengthy banner proclaiming, "Everyone must strive towards making a better life for the people and to build a strong and prosperous nation," a woman dragged an immense bundle of clothes behind her on a tiny trolley, a boy walking by her side. "Out our cameras came. Mr. Hyun hit the mic. Please do not take photographs." A woman squatting by the side of the road. In front of her a small white placard. Was she selling something? Begging? "No photos! No photos!" commanded Mr. Hyun. In the river, a woman was washing her clothes. You see this all the time in Africa, but there the temperature is warm. It was freezing cold here, and in late March lumps of ice were still to be found in places away from the sun. For a woman to do her daily washing in a freezing river tells you things, that there is no regular supply of running water at her home, no washing machine, no cheap laundrette. Further on the bank of the riverbed, two women were scavenging for something in the mud. "No photos, no photos," said Mr. Hyun. Now that we were seeing more of the real North Korea, I felt more irritated that our every moment was choreographed by our minders. They took us to the heavy machine complex showroom, yet another grandiloquent chunk of concrete hemming public good while ordinary people lived in squalor. At the back of the room was an enormous diptych of Kim's Major and Minor, standing on a mountain top with wispy clouds caressing their feet, the backdrop dark pink, an exact copy of the portrait of the two Kims in our hotel. Occupying most of the space was a model of the complex, complete with tiny trains and a proud chimney. "We make heavy electrical power machines," the local guide, sporting a vivid orange traditional Korean dress, said. And then the lights went out. In the electricity-generating machine factory, no electricity. She carried on in the gloom while we tittered our disbelief. "This is embarrassing," I boomed. Their film of our trip features the complex model in Stygian gloom. Clearly the cameraman wasn't shooting in the brief moments before the power outage. The tragicomedy of North Korean power supply is that there isn't enough homegrown energy in the country to maintain full power. The country does not trade enough to make good the energy deficit through imports, and the demands of the palace are so warped they deprive the rest of the economy of the energy it needs to thrive. That last element was beautifully explained by Hwang Chong-yop, the highest-level defector ever. Hwang, who fled in 1997, recalled a revealing moment at the party's central committee meeting. After a series of blackouts in Pyongyang, Hwang isn't clear, but most likely back in the 1980s, Kim Il-sung asked the Minister of Electric Power to explain why he had been inconvenienced by brownouts or decreases in electricity supply when watching movies. The minister stood up to reply, "Currently there is not enough electric power to meet the requirements of the factories. Because of the heavy load in transmission to the factories, the voltage of electricity supplied to Pyongyang tends to drop." Kim Won replied, "Then why can't you adjust the power supply transmitted to factories and allocate more to Pyongyang?" The minister explained, "That would stop operations in a lot of factories." Kim cut him off and ordered, "I don't care if all the factories in the country stop production. Just send enough electricity to Pyongyang." On our visit, the only place where warmth and light seemed guaranteed was the mausoleum, an absurd distortion of priorities which would never happen in a functioning democracy. The brownouts and power cuts always led to a muffled cheer or sardonic grins on our trip, proof positive that the regime's propaganda was dross. But it speaks a deeper truth about the abject failure of a command economy to deliver economic satisfaction to the greatest number. Hwang set out the fabulous bureaucratic merry-go-round under Kim Jong-il when rival bits of the state wanted their lights on and there wasn't enough power to go around. The defector wrote that in 1996, North Korea produced 2 million kilowatts of electricity, only a fifth of what was required. Back then, there were 15,000 factories needing 10 million kilowatts. Of the 2 million kilowatts available, 0.8 million was needed for vital facilities where the power supply could not be cut. Wastage through faulty and ancient wiring burnt up 0.2 million kilowatts en route, leaving only 1 million kilowatts. This dire shortage of electricity meant that the key government agencies, one would assume the secret police, the army, and the party, went directly to Kim Jong-il without going through the cabinet or the National Planning Committee to ask for priority in power supply. These requests were sanctioned by Kim Jong-il, and his word was law. The agencies took Kim Tu's orders to the Ministry of Electric Power and demanded that they be given top priority in electrical supply. The ministry could not meet Kim Jong-il's orders. Instead, it went back to the dear leader, telling him that there was nothing the ministry could do. "Kim Jong-il," wrote Hwang, "handed the appeal to the secretaries in the party's central committee and gave them the task of resolving the problem through discussions." Not for nothing does former British Ambassador John Everard compare the North Korean regime to Kafka as performed by Dad's Army. We asked for a tour of the heavy machine complex. In the unlit gloom, Miss Jun heroically translated for the local guide. "Now, the Korea Peninsula situation is getting worse and worse, on the verge of civil war, so now they're producing military things so they can't show the whole factory." This may have been true. Most defectors say that all the military factories are in the mountains. To us, it seemed a pitiful excuse, like telling the schoolteacher, "I'm sorry, sir, but the dog ate my jute chair homework." What kind of industrial complex is it that has no smoke, no power, and no noise? In the early 1980s, I worked on the Sheffield Telegraph, before the high-volume steel industry died, and many a night I went to sleep listening to the rhythmic banging from the steel mills. The Da'an complex was silent, no sound of any work being done. In the blackout, the male toilets were impenetrable, so we pissed outside. The manufacture of urine was the only product of the Da'an heavy machine complex that day. Our route back to Pyongyang took us through the poor area of Da'an town again. An ox pulled a meagre cart, Old people moved hither and yon, seemingly without purpose. A man pulled a handcart, his breath ballooning out as the temperature dropped below freezing. The poverty of wealth and soul was grinding, and grindingly obvious. Mr. Hyun and Miss June were even more on their guard. "No photos, no photos," they cried out, as joylessly as the scene in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, when they call out, "Bring out your dead!" John Everard suffered from this censor complex so much he called his book Only Beautiful, Please. He recalls that the security forces did not follow him and his staff everywhere because North Koreans policed them well enough. The moment the foreigner did anything upsetting, a crowd formed and the security forces appeared quickly. The most common trigger for this was illicit photography. Koreans are very conscious of their country's image, and any attempt to photograph any aspect of their country that was less than flattering of their country angered them. A Korean People's Army officer, proud of his English, once explained the rule to me as, "Only beautiful, please." Is this a display of patriotism, or is this regime brainwashing at work, so deep in people's minds that even foreigners must conform at the national lie factory? At a bridge over a river, we had to stop because our coach was too high to pass underneath a pole stretched across the road for some reason. Our driver got out to have a row with whoever was manning the checkpoint. A lorry full of hay overtook, but riding on top of the load was a man who would surely come a cropper. As the lorry got up to the pole, he stood up and nimbly jumped over it and landed back safely on the hay, and the lorry sped on into the dusk. It was as nimbly executed as the Buster Keaton stunt when the front of a house falls on top of him and he emerges unscathed through a window. A light, silly moment, but also proof that these people, under another system, might be bright and fun and full of life. But of that, in the Da'an heavy machine complex, we saw no sign. Chapter 5. Jimmy the Gold Smuggler. Alejandro Caldepenos's website sings the praises of the Juche-oriented socialist state which embodies the idea and leadership of Comrade Kim Il-sung, the founder of the Republic and the father of socialist Korea, on one page, and the joys of doing capitalist business in North Korea on another. The Hermit Kingdom, says Caldepenos, will become the most important trading hub in Northeast Asia in the next few years, boasting the lowest labor costs in Asia and workers who show the utmost loyalty. As opposed to other Asian countries, workers will not abandon their positions for higher salaries once they are trained. That might be, perhaps, because they and their families could be sent to the gulag for three generations if they do. On and on, Caldepenos goes. Lowest taxes scheme in Asia. A government with solid security and very stable political work without corruption. Transparent legal work. None of that is true. In The Big Zombie, we endured a surreal and surreally boring meeting with three North Koreans who were selling the idea of business opportunities in the country. A PowerPoint presentation followed with Venn diagrams sporting nomically entitled spheres such as Economic Investment and Joint Venture Committee. Business gibberish had arrived in Pyongyang big time. I didn't want to bring attention to myself because the entrepreneurs had email and, therefore, either in Pyongyang or more likely in Beijing, access to the internet. They were clearly in the elite of the core class, especially licensed by the regime to come and go at will. Remember, there are only two flights between Beijing and Pyongyang a week, so this license covers just a few thousand people. All of them will have family in North Korea. All of them know that if they defect, their family will suffer horribly. But I couldn't quite forget the sight of the poor North Korean woman doing her washing in the freezing river, So I put up my hand and asked, "Why would anyone invest in a country if its leader is threatening thermonuclear war against the United States?" Silence followed. After a long pause, someone mumbled something about not being involved in politics, a statement that doesn't quite wash inside the world's most totalitarian regime, and the meeting droned on. Leaving aside the threat of Armageddon, North Korea ought to be a smashing investment opportunity for the more icy-hearted capitalist. In 2007, a worker's monthly wage in the comparatively wealthy region around Pyongyang was estimated at around £40, $60, €50, before tax. If you can get away with paying your workers £1.50 a day, then why isn't everyone piling in? The downside, apart from the government being as crazy as a box of frogs, is that everything else doesn't work or costs an arm and a leg. The power supply is a joke. We experienced at least one power cut every day we were in North Korea, some days more than one. The railway system is largely electrified, so delays of several days come as standard. As far as shipping goes, the West Sea barrage restricts ships to 50,000 tonnage, pitifully small in today's world, and the locks can only handle one ship a day. Worse, the docks are comically old-fashioned and controlled by the military, who charge extortionate rates. For example, one container shipped from the South Korean port of Incheon to Nampo costs $1,000, almost as much as a journey to Europe. The round trip takes 24 hours for a journey of only 60 miles. That means business investors have to fork out enormous sums on simple logistics, so the vast majority don't bother. Despite all this, I did meet one North Korean entrepreneur, but not in North Korea. Meet Jimmy the Gold Smuggler. He's a tiny chap, only 5'2" tall, but he carries with him his own personal high-voltage charge. Jimmy, not his real name, is lithe and vivid and, as the North Korean regime found out to their cost, as hard to control as an electric eel. He was the runt of the litter, far smaller than his two brothers who ended up in the army. When he was little, his big brothers would save his bacon when he got into a scrap. His family were ordinary folk, his father a factory worker off sick because of bronchitis, his mother working on a farm,